The Weekly Connect
on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is the show that connects you with other blind and partially sighted people to talk about the issues that matter to all of us with sight loss. Hello, I'm Stephen Scott, and over the course of the next hour, we are going to continue to discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly of life with sight loss. Although I must say, lots of good seems to be coming out of this week's show already. Yes, coming up, we're going to find out how a small change in attitude by blind woman Julie Woods in New Zealand has made a huge difference to her life.
Saying why not has meant that I've been open to the opportunities that have come my way as a blind woman.
Also, we hear another great story of the relationship between guide dog and owner. Lynette Proctor talks about her guide dog, Pippa.
Yes, she's helped me get out and about, but she's also allowed me to do even more than I'd ever expected.
And later, we hear from Steve Bates, the first blind person to climb El Capitan in Yosemite National Park in California.
It was really important that everything I did skills-based wise had to be second nature, and I had to rely on my subconscious to do that.
That's a lot to come on this week's Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
But we're going to start this week, as always, with our top story. And this week we're talking about transport. Now, if you are one who uses passenger assistance when you go on a train or you go on a plane, then this is the kind of conversation you might want to get yourself involved in over the next couple of weeks. We're going to be continuing this discussion on transport and really getting into the heart of what are the problems, the issues and the good things about travelling around the UK by bus, taxi, train or plane. Well, joining us this week to talk about transport and getting around from A to B successfully, or not successfully as the case may be, are three prominent ladies who all have views on this. We've got Stacey Rowe, we've got Sarah Ledbetter, and we've got Alex Mackey on the line. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
So we're talking this week about transport and the whole issue of getting around from A to B. And it's a really interesting topic, I guess, because a lot of us as blind or partially sighted people do have mixed feelings, mixed emotions and mixed experiences of getting around. And we thought we'd talk about that first up this week on the Weekly Connect. Stacey Rowe, I'll come to you first. Tell me your experience of getting around and what the good, the bad and the ugly of transport is for you.
Thank you, Stephen. So my experience is quite varied, and I would say it's changed an awful lot. So if I think back even just, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there were no talking buses. There wasn't as much support in terms of staff at stations. So it's quite incredible now. And I used to live in Scotland, and I now live in London, and we have a very helpful service, as a lot of people will know. Where, you know, you can turn up and just request assistance and they'll show you to, you know, your tube. They'll meet you at the other end. And it's definitely changed my life in terms of independence. And I've heard that from a lot of people. I've travelled a lot in my life, and I've never seen a system as good as the one in the UK. It's really quite spectacular in what it can offer. Not 100% perfect, I must say. When I first arrived in London, I was actually banned from using Victoria Station indefinitely by a very grumpy man because there was overcrowding to get onto the underground. And he said, absolutely not am I helping a VIP, you know, visually impaired person.
Wow.
And I said, well, you can't refuse me. I need to get to, I think I was going to, you know, Green Park or something. And he said, well, you have to find another way. You can't use the tube. And I was polite about it, but I was quite firm that that was, you know, discrimination and it wasn't acceptable. And we had a massive argument about it. And he was very, very nasty. And he said, you know, that's it. I'm going to ensure that you're never allowed in this station again, which obviously it's not policeable. And, you know, he asked for my name, which I didn't give because he was going to ban me from the station. I've managed to talk to TfL, and they had a word with him about that. And
so you were actually labelled as, you know, you are a VIP person, a visually impaired person, and, you know, as such, I don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very much, we do not have the time for you to support you when we've got all of this going on. And it was rush hour, And how dare you travel at rush hour when you know you need support? It was very unpleasant. And I was very new to London, so it was really upsetting at the time because I thought, oh, wow, I've just moved here. Is this what it's like? And it's not like that. It's absolutely not. But it was really quite upsetting at the time, that incident.
Okay. Alex Mackey is on the line. Alex, whereabouts in the country are you, first off? And have you had similar experiences or better experiences than Stacey Rowe?
Well, I'm from Durham. It's a very small city, but in actual fact, I used to call it a village. It's that small. So, to be honest, I actually think train travel is a lot easier than the bus. Mm-hmm. mainly because in Durham, we don't really have talking buses. We do have some talking buses, but we don't have a lot of them. But to be fair to them, when we don't have any talks on, and even if we do, the bus drivers are absolutely fabulous at shouting down the bus saying, "You stop here, pet." So it's been really lovely with the buses. With the train travel, I find that really shocking and interesting. But since I've gone and had a speaking session with a group of people that are trying to make a new app called Access-Me or something like that, I met a guy in a wheelchair, and he was very dead against disabled people just turning up and getting train travel. And the main reason why he was really annoyed was because he says, the problem is that because of those who don't actually bother to ask for help, the ones who do bother to ask for help and book never actually get the help. Or alternatively, they get on the train and they find that they don't have the room for the wheelchair because there's some of the persons sitting there or standing there with, let's say, a guide dog or a pair of crutches or a broken leg. And he just got a bit frustrated about that, and he felt that it was a bit annoying. And the other thing that I find about rail staff, and I know that most blind people, when I say this, will hate me for it, but I think it's dead true. I think that in actual fact, you can travel from wherever you are to another, from A to B really easily. And in some cases that I know of, people haven't actually bought tickets. And they've just booked the rail assist, because you can book the rail assist separately to booking the ticket. And the rail assist, because they think you're a disabled person and therefore will never ever steal from you and that you're all angels, never bother to look or check. So you can get from A to B without even paying.
There's some great experiences of what I think we could term presumed innocence, perhaps with blind and partially sighted people, possibly disabled people generally. Sarah Ledbetter is also with us. What's your view on all of this?
Hello, I'm from Leicestershire. I actually live in a small village called Narborough. And no, they don't all think disabled people are angels, because they're always double-checking me in the disability part of the train, so I always have to pay. Because my travel pass doesn't actually work in the county, but people in the city can still use it. We've got no order description on the buses. Now and again it does work that the drivers do remember to say, it's your stop. Before now, they've said it's your stop and let me off the bus at completely the wrong stop. Luckily, a nice lady came along and took me to the stop where my friend was waiting for me. And luckily, I wasn't late for my hospital appointment. I need a ramp to get on the train because it's a big gap. And we have to rely on cross-country trains guards, which majority of the time they're very nice and will put it down. But sometimes I have a difficulty getting on the train. The assistance is very good. I always book my assistance, but sometimes I don't have the room for other people as well, sort of thing. But the staff are very helpful. They get me on and off the train, and I travel majority of the time by train, but it's quicker to get where I want to get to, and there's more room for my guide dog as well.
I just thought maybe I should profess my innocence in the fact that I have paid for my tickets most of the time. And in fact, all of the time. So just in case, staff in
I did. Yeah, they normally do smile at me and think, oh, poor person, the guide dog, but I did get to my stop the other day and I say, no, I don't want to owe it you, I want to pay. But majority of the time we do have friendly assistance, but sometimes the staff are very grumpy and don't want to put the ramp down and don't want to give the right assistance on the train travel.
Okay, but I don't think we should be knocking assistance too much, guys, do you think? Because, let's be honest about it, it's a great job that everybody does. And, you know, we will always find in life people who are just a bit grumpy because they've had a bad day. I mean, Stacey, you've had a particularly bad example of that.
Yeah, but, you know, I absolutely agree with you. I would not knock the assistants at all. I'm probably its biggest fan. I couldn't do most of what I do without that assistance being there. I couldn't get around London. It's crucial for me working, for me travelling, for me doing everything. And more than nine times out of ten, they're fantastic. And they're so really, really well trained. They're great guiding, and they're also just really welcoming and friendly. It's a great thing. And I've had some lovely, you know, nights out where I've missed the last train and they've been so supportive and helpful. Or, you know, I remember once I was coming back from a dance class and one of them gave me a little tango lesson on the platform. And you know, you can get some really good tickets, as they would say, and they're such fun, and they can actually make your day much better if you're having a bad day and you meet a really friendly, you know, member of train staff. It can really help you. It's a really good, really great thing.
But one thing that comes through from everything you've all said is that on average, assistance is okay. We have our daily issues with it, perhaps. But buses in particular seem to be a real issue. That is a common thread, I think, that, you know, in London, for example, there are talking buses. There are some in some areas, but it's in other areas there's nothing at all. So clearly there's some disparity there.
Yeah, there definitely is, because I say it would really make... There's only one bus in Leicestershire that actually has got talking audio description on it, and it really would be helpful if you had got the talking description on it to let me know where I am, because I feel I have to ask the other passengers on the bus, or the bus driver's busy, is he going to remember to tell me? And you don't really want to be dropped off in a place you don't really know at all.
I do want to say, although I have said that bus travel is harder than train travel, assistance really does impress me, particularly when I go in an aeroplane. And I have been previously in an aeroplane without my guide dog, I must confess. But aeroplane staff in assistance from one country to another, like Spain or Italy or France, has impressed me no end. They know who you are. They know where you need to go. They know which cases are yours. I mean, that's pretty damn clever, really. So, you know, I just wanted to make a point just to make sure that, you know, people like rail assists aren't taken a mick out of. Because I think it's quite ungrateful of us to take, you know, the travel, take the assistance without paying for it, you know. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that I'd like to say is that we are dealing with the taxi issue and guide dogs at the moment really, really well. And I feel that at some stage, especially with the particular law that we've got here at the moment, that problem should soon stop, really.
Okay, so we've talked about buses and trains, and you've also mentioned planes, but now you're talking about taxis, which is the natural place to go. A lot of blind people, we do use taxis, probably more than we maybe want to, just because sometimes it's easier. Maybe let's go around the table on that particular one. Stacey, what's your thoughts on using taxis? What's your experiences been?
Well, because I live in London, I never get taxis because they're really expensive.
Don't bother with them.
I can't afford them. But when I come to Scotland, I love a dual taxi, I have to say. I love getting in a taxi. They're very helpful. You get to, from A to B, and you get a lot of great banter. So I'm a taxi fan.
Okay, Sarah? What's your view on taxis?
I've had some good experiences. I came to London the other week to see a theatre show, and there's a lovely taxi driver, really talkative, said if it goes over £10, I'm not charging you ladies, and he wouldn't do it, and that's a good experience. I've had other experiences saying, I don't want to take your dog, it's dirty, it's going to put hair all over the chairs and whatever, but that's a small amount of people. Majority of people are very friendly, very helpful, and it's a good way to travel.
I've had mixed experiences, but most of them have been fabulous with taxi drivers. I mean, obviously, I have a guide dog myself. I think the worst taxi driver discussion or bit of banter that I had with the taxi driver was in terms of guide dogs, because I was thinking of doing my study on guide dogs in religious places. So I thought I'd test it out and asked him, as a Muslim, how do you feel about guide dogs? Not actually realising that Muslims don't generally allow your guide dog in their taxi. And he said, well, I say Muslim, the real technical phrase is Islamic. But, you know, he'd said that basically he doesn't really understand why they allow them in restaurants either. And that if it was up to him, that they wouldn't have them in a restaurant either. So, you know, I'm glad that we've started, you know, standing down on what the rules are for taxis, because, you know, I'm all up for religious tolerance, but there are points where you have to put your foot down and say, look, I'm really sorry, but, you know, you're a minority, so is this population a minority, so where do we draw the line? And I'm glad that we're starting to draw that line now, so much so that I actually think that in public places like taxis and churches and other places like restaurants, we have that freedom to go with our dogs.
Well, I would say, though, Alex, is I think it's an interesting point you bring up, but I think it's also fair to say that there are a lot of people who have been thrown out of taxis with guide dogs by people who are not Muslim.
I think
that's an interesting distinction.
I'm fully aware of that.
That's an interesting distinction, though, because, you know, this isn't a racial problem. This is an issue with people and dogs in their cars. And some people, appears to some of the stories that we've found that, you know, it's just down to, oh, I just don't like dogs, so I don't want you in my car. Or I don't want, you know, a blind person in their hair shedding dog in my car. You know? Anyone else got a view on that one?
I was just wondering about, because correct me if I'm wrong, Alex. I mean, the taxi driver didn't actually ask you to get out of the car. You know, he was taking you in his taxi.
And
the only thing I would say is, from your story, I mean, you did ask his opinion. What he thought of having guide dogs. And I suppose that people are entitled to their opinion, I suppose, and as long as they don't, you know, deny you a service, then they can dislike your dog and they can say, well, I don't think it should be allowed in restaurants. As long as it doesn't create a barrier, then I guess, you know, it is an opinion. That's my only thought on that.
Yeah, we've all worked with people we may not necessarily want to socialise with, but
exactly.
It doesn't stop us turning up at work.
You know, I mean, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have your opinions, because you should. I'm just saying that, it's an interesting social mobility perspective, as in, what we'd allow and what we wouldn't allow. Now, at the end of the day, attitudes to guide dogs vary from country to country as well.
Okay.
And just from people to people. So.
Okay, bring in Sarah Ledbetter on this one, just to give us your view on this.
So I've had one person taxi, it wasn't actually any race or religion, it was a white taxi firm, and they said, oh, we don't want a guide dog, and they didn't turn up, and it's only because we rang them up to find out where they were, and they said, you moved from where you was, says, no, we never moved, and when they finally came to pick us up, I didn't get back to home until about just before 12 o'clock, and other times I've tried to clean the taxi outside my house, but like you say, it's good to have the discussion and to find out what people's opinions are, but as long as it don't stop you going in restaurants and doing things that you need to do on a regular basis, because you need that guide dog to take you places and to give you independence.
So to wrap up what has been, I think, a very frank discussion, and I thank you for putting your opinions forward, what would be the one thing that you would want to happen that could make getting around from A to B just that little bit easier, based on all the experiences you've had? Stacey, I'll start with you.
Interestingly, it sort of goes against a point that Alex made earlier, but I would like to see an improvement in air travel. I think that would be a great thing, because for me, I find that there's far too much, there's far too many occasions where, you know, you turn up and sometimes, I'm travelling with someone sighted and I don't need any assistance, but they insist that I need to tell them, that they need to tell the pilot that I'm on board. I don't know why that would be. And I've had other occasions, many occasions, and I'm sure people can relate to this, where they absolutely insist you must go in a wheelchair. And then you have to have that argument. Maybe you've had a 10-hour flight and you have to have this discussion about, well, I don't need a wheelchair, I'm perfectly capable of walking. And I think there's still a lot more work needs to be done around airline and making sure that they're accessible to everybody and that you have a pleasant experience, because, you know, it certainly costs enough for you to use them, so you want to enjoy it.
Okay. Alex, Mackie, what do you think?
guys at taxi firms, do us a favour. If you know the taxi driver in question does not like or want to have a dog in their car, do not send them. Because it's not fair on them and it's not fair on us.
Okay.
And that's about it, really.
Okay, thank you for that. And Sarah Ledbetter?
Taxi drivers, again, because some of them think they can charge extra because you've got a guide dog. And also sometimes, yes, I think the assistance on trains is really, really good, but my own station, they never bother to phone through and let poor the end station know that I'm going to be there. And I turn up and nobody meets them, which is no fault of their own. So better communication between the different stations that are actually offering the assistance for train travel.
Okay, well, again, thank you for your frank opinions and views, because I think it will raise a lot of conversation, as it should. That's what it's about here on the Weekly Connect. It's, you know, your views, no topic off limits. If you've got something to say, this is the place to say it. We appreciate that from Sarah Ledbetter, Stacey Rowe and Alex Mackey. Thanks for joining us.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
This is the Weekly Connect, and don't forget we're a podcast. You can get us on Audio Boom if you want to do that. We are coming soon to iTunes as well, so keep checking iTunes and you'll be able to get us there. If you want to get in touch with the programme, you can do that in a couple of ways. You can email us, weeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Your email could be read out here on the programme. You can also tweet as well using the hashtag #TheWeeklyConnect, #TheWeeklyConnect on Twitter. And of course, you can always find us on Facebook as well. Search for RNIB and RNIB Connect Radio. Now, last week on the show, we talked about the issue of white canes and asked the question, do we like or dislike the cane? Well, we had quite an animated discussion with Madeline Mann and Mohammed Atif and also Fiona Dunn, who joined us to talk about that, and also some great calls as well. I think those of you who listened last week may well remember Sarah in Manchester talking about the issue of using a cane in public for the first time, something she's trying to grapple with but struggling. Well, lots of interesting comments coming in on Twitter. Common Sense says, well, with better and earlier mobility training, I doubt this would be a topic of discussion. So that comes down to earlier rehabilitation, using the white cane when you're younger. That could be an interesting point of discussion there. Thanks, Common Sense, for that. DJ Morpheus says, I think his real name is Carl, actually, because that's what it says in in brackets next to DJ Morpheus. For me, he says, it depends on how people react when they see the cane. Some are great, some can be really nasty and offensive, or do something really stupid, like stick their foot out to attempt to try and trip you up. It can be, and usually is, invaluable, though. Well, there you go. Some interesting comments on Twitter. Share your views. You can send us a message on Twitter, #TheWeeklyConnect. Follow our discussion, of course, there by just following the hashtag, #TheWeeklyConnect. Or you can email us, weeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. And a lot of you talking as well online about the how to record using your iPhone feature we did a couple of weeks ago. If you want to know more about that, then I would encourage you to go to the podcast, the Weekly Connect podcast, and download How to Record on Your iPhone. It's a great way to find out how to record using your smartphone. Now, each week on the programme, we feature a Society of the Week. It's a chance to give recognition to so many charities and organisations out there that are doing fabulous work in the community to help people with sight loss. Here's another. This is the Macula Society.
My name's Judy Pride, and I'm one of the regional managers for the Macula Society, and I cover the Southwest. The Macula Society is here to support everyone who's going through the low vision journey because they have macular degeneration. And because we know that journey is unique to everyone, we try to offer services and support that will fill that gap for everyone on an individual basis. Macula Society offers all sorts of help and support, and our first port of call for most people is our helpline, and they will be there from 9 to 5 on weekdays to answer all of the questions that someone who's just been told they have macular degeneration has, and they will signpost you to the most appropriate support in your own local area, as well as perhaps suggesting that you pop along to one of our groups where you can sit alongside someone else who really understands what it's like to have your life change dramatically in such a short period of time. And those groups are fantastic, somewhere to really let your hair down, learn from each other, and actually enjoy being normal and not having to worry for a few moments about the fact that you can't quite see as well as you used to be able to. And those groups are spread widely across the UK, and I'm sure that there's a group very close to wherever you are. We also provide, of course, lots of information in a format that everybody can relate to. And that information ranges from details about the condition through to how you perhaps are going through your treatment, right through to things like the Charles Bonnet syndrome. If you need a little bit more of a helping hand and perhaps a listening ear, our counsellors are amazing. And we can offer up to 6-hour sessions via the telephone, particularly for those people struggling to come to terms with their new life. We have a befriending service, so perhaps if you're living on your own and you would like someone to give you a call on a regular basis, just on a friendly basis, so that perhaps you have a shared interest in opera or light music or sport, you know that someone's going to give you a call who perhaps also understands what you're going through. For those people who really want to get to grips with how they can live their life on a very positive basis, perhaps we can offer training in eccentric viewing. That means that we can help you use the vision you have left, that peripheral vision, to its very best extent. And I have been delighted to sit alongside people who have been so thrilled to suddenly say, I can see a face again, which is really uplifting.
Hi, my name's Ken Eggleston. I'm a retired dairy farmer from the lovely Vale of Beaver. I've been aware that I had a problem with my eyesight since the 90s, but it was only when I went to get an HGV license in the year 2000. The DVLA and their wisdom took my license away. But in 2012, it was getting increasingly difficult. So at that point, I became registered as partially sighted. As a result of that, somewhere along the line, I became aware of the Macular Society. So I joined on this free membership deal, and I got the magazine and was reading my first issue, and it told me about a competition. And it said, opportunity to drive a supercar. So I entered that, and on we went. The supercar day was a great thing. I've sort of driven all my life, and I can drive anything, and always taken a joy and a pleasure in doing it. And there were various cars that you were able to nominate, and one of the ones that caught my eye was a 1967 Ford Mustang. Bright red. It looked like the paint was half an inch thick. It looked gorgeous. It sounded terrific. And I thought, great, I'm going to get the chance to go up and down the runway. So that's what we did. And I said at the time, if that's the last chance I get to drive, then so be it, you know. So, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was wonderful to have this sort of experience and be able to do something that I thought I'd never be able to do again. I've got to say, I've been thoroughly impressed with all the contact I've had with them, find them a really go-getting outfit. You know, they're focused, they're moving forward, they're doing a good job. And, you know, I'm very pleased to be a part of it.
We are thrilled that so many people will hear now about the Macular Society and what we can offer. And we are so keen to make sure that everybody gets the support we can show. Please, we would love you to become a member. And in fact, membership is free for the first 6 months. And all you need to do is ring our helpline number on 0300 30 30 111. So we'll wait for that call.
Thanks, Judy. And if you want more information about the Macular Society, you can go to their website. As Judy says, it's macularsociety.org. Another Society of the Week. Well done, guys. If you would like to nominate your society, maybe it's a local society that's done something really good for you and you think they deserve some recognition here on the Weekly Connect that goes out across the UK and around the world as a podcast and on air. Well, you know what? Let's get their name on Society of the Week. Email us weeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk, or you can use the hashtag on Twitter when you send us a message. You can do that by just adding the hashtag TheWeeklyConnect.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Now to an interesting story of achievement from two guys, actually. Red Zell lives with retinitis pigmentosa. He's an author, and he is the first man to climb the Old Man of Hoy in Scotland 20 years after being diagnosed with RP. Now, Steve Bates also lives with retinitis pigmentosa and was one of the cycling stars of the Paralympics. He got 2 golds and 1 bronze. Before that, though, he was the first blind person to climb El Capitan in Yosemite National Park in California. Now, Red invited Steve to talk about his ascent and their shared passion for climbing.
So, Steve, welcome and congratulations.
Thanks very much. Yeah, cheers. Thanks for having me in today.
So, take me back to 2011 when you'd come over from New Zealand, you'd settled up in Moray, and what were you doing then?
So, I actually came to the UK in May of 2000, so I'd been here quite a while. But in 2011 up in Moray, I was an outdoor instructor. So I worked with disadvantaged young children for a particular charity, and we basically took disadvantaged young people out climbing, cycling, all that kind of outdoor activity stuff to to improve people's confidence and things like that, and show the world or these youngsters that you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to be at school, that there's plenty of other things outside of school that you can succeed at in life, and I was certainly like that when I was at school. I was no brainstorm child, so I left when I was 15 and cracked on with a carpentry career, and so I ended up in Moray in Scotland of all places, which is absolutely stunning and beautiful, and then I had the fateful day on the 14th of June in 2011, which kind of changed things around a bit.
I was going to say, it's not exactly the ideal news to receive when you're a mountain instructor. I mean, I know we both climb and we're both blind, but actually there's a lot of visual safety that you're expected to do.
Yeah, I think so. We do what we do, and it's fine when you're putting yourself or your good friends at risk. That's okay. But yeah, when you've got other people's children, which you are, responsible for, that kind of changes the dynamics quite a bit. And yeah, I think it was that was my biggest concern, was I still going to be able to do my job? And when I was diagnosed, and the charity were absolutely amazing at kind of supporting me through that. But it became pretty apparent to me that things were going to have to change quite drastically, and that life of trying to become a rock climbing guide kind of ended for me, really.
Now, describe what you did over the next 2 years before the summer of 2013.
Well, I think probably similar to yourself, I didn't quite sulk for a couple of decades, but I certainly had my period of sulking, and for me it was kind of 6 to 8 weeks, I think, I think the thing that annoyed me the most is how angry I was with myself, and I couldn't, no one understood, but I was fit, I was healthy, I didn't drink that much, I didn't smoke, and I just, I really felt like, why is my body doing this to me? What have I done to you, and why do I deserve this? And that was the main thing for me, I think. I was very angry at myself for no particular reason, really. And then it all changed when I met Andy Kirkpatrick, who for those of you who have never heard of Andy, he is an amazing British climber, alpinist, big wall soloist. He's climbed El Cap now over 25 times, I think. And Andy said to me, when he found out I was going, would potentially go blind, he said, "Well, you may as well solo El Cap before you go completely blind."
And this is El Capitan out in Yosemite, a vertical 1 kilometer high rock face.
Indeed. When I went out there were going to be days where it was going to be absolutely relentless. I was going to be absolutely exhausted. And soloing, you cannot afford to make mistakes. It just, they could be the last mistake you ever make. So it was really important that everything I did, skills-based wise, had to be second nature, and I had to rely on my subconscious to do that.
And this is when you got in touch with me. For me, it was just terrific to know that there was somebody else out there who was singing off the same song sheet as me. I got to the top of the Old Man of Hoy, and then 2 days later, I think, after a couple of wobbly moments, you got to the top of El Cap. But tell me about the journey there, because you've been very honest about how you had last-minute doubts.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think through all of the things that I've done, people seem to think that you're inhuman in that respect. You just go and do stuff and you achieve everything you put your mind to. And I've had more failures in my life than I ever have had successes. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we don't come on the radio, or we don't go and meet the Queen when we've failed. So no one's really too interested, to be honest. So yeah, you know, people only see the successes and they think it comes easy and it's a natural thing. And, you know, people use the word talented, which I really, really despise. But if they're there, you know, like it's great to be told that, but there's a lot of hard work goes into all these things. And I think the scariest thing was starting to climb, really, by far. I know that's what you want to hear, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say, for me, the first step off the ground is always the most difficult. It you know, it might be the least far to fall, but actually persuading your foot to go to the first foothold and hauling yourself up to the first ledge is always making that first move.
Yeah, but it was a second climb, a route called Lurking Fear, which sounds a lot more horrific than what it actually is. It's one of the easier climbs on El Cap. And we did that in 4 days, and I actually did some of the leading on that. And that was when, all of a sudden, I realised how difficult I was going to find it through my visual impairment. We summited out after on the fourth day, and we walked off and actually ended up phoning my wife, Caroline. And I was in tears because I thought, I knew that my dream of soloing El Cap was gone. Mm. You know, it was just, you know, there was a very, very realistic chance I was going to kill myself. And it didn't matter if I failed, but I had to give it a go. I couldn't walk away and not try, because that was letting everyone down.
Do you know, I mean, I do think that rock climbing is perfect for setting you up for pushing yourself that little bit further. It teaches you how to fail, but it teaches you also how to come back, because it's one of those activities where it is a series of problems that when you link them together properly, it works. Thank you very much for coming in and joining us in the studio.
Cheers, thank you.
Interesting story there from Red Zell, speaking to Steve Bates about their shared passion for climbing. Really interesting to listen in on that conversation. If you want to share your views, and maybe you have a conversation that you'd like to share with us on any topic at all, because remember, it's your show, it's your program, we give you the microphone. Literally, we've given you a microphone. We've told you how to use your iPhone to get in touch. You can email your thoughts to us, weeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk, or if you want to send us a comment on Twitter, then please do that using the hashtag TheWeeklyConnect. Now, those of you who are regular listeners will know that every week on the programme we feature voices from around the world. It's called World Connect, and this week we are going to focus on a woman called Julie Woods from New Zealand. Now, Julie started off life fully sighted. She ended up partially sighted through an eye condition which is called Stargardt's disease. But now she's lost her sight entirely. At the age of 37, in fact, she lost her sight entirely. Now, for many people, that can be seen as the devastating part of their lives. That is it. It's over. But for Julie, she took a rather different approach, as she tells us now in her story, which we've entitled, Don't Say No, Say Why Not?
Hi, I'm that blind woman, Julie Woods, and I live in Dunedin, New Zealand, which is the Edinburgh of the South. So I was born totally sighted, the youngest child of three, and at the age of 18, in my last year of high school, I noticed the print on the blackboard was shimmering. And it started to move further away from me. I went down to my local hospital and was diagnosed with Stargardt's disease. So I became partially sighted at the age of 18. I spent the next 4 years at university, I'll say suffering a Bachelor of Commerce degree. Started in the back row of the lecture theatre, ended up in the front, but carried on nonetheless, and then went and worked in Wellington, in our capital city, and worked for the government. It wasn't until 1997, when I was 31 years of age and I was married, I was back in Dunedin with my husband and I had two boys, aged 3 and 1, that I noticed the vinyl in our bathroom was shimmering. And this time I was diagnosed with inflammation of the retina, and within 3 months I lost most of my remaining vision. And it was a time where I felt powerless and overwhelmed and had no idea of how I was going to cope. And fortunately, I got to the point where I was eligible for membership at the Blind Foundation in New Zealand. And that was like coming home and finding my brothers and sisters. And it was okay that I couldn't see. And I began to see them do things that I thought I could never do. And that was another important step for me, to actually watch and observe those other blind people read with their fingers, read with their ears, use their white cane, travel on planes, cook, clean, iron, mow their lawns, use chainsaws, do all the things that I thought blind people couldn't do. So I guess I brought my own stereotype of blindness to being blind, and it wasn't until I mixed with them that I really noticed that actually it was my limiting beliefs and I needed to shift those. And as I said, watching other blind people do the things I thought I couldn't was hugely liberating. I was at the Blind Foundation one day wandering up the corridor and I was approached by the recreation officer, and she said to me, "Julie, we're taking a group of blind people away cross-country skiing. Would you like to come?" And I thought, cross-country skiing? That sounds really dangerous, you know, and something might happen to me. What if I fell over? And, you know, a bunch of blind people, that's a bit random. I was still kind of in that stage. And I politely declined. And I went home and I sat on the safety of my couch that night and I thought, you stupid woman, what kind of blind person are you going to make if you turn down opportunities that come your way? So from that moment on, I decided to turn my no into why not. And if anyone asked me to do anything, rather than say no, I would say why not. I would try it once. If I didn't like it, I wouldn't have to do it again, but at least it would be an informed choice. So saying why not has led me to do many, many things that I possibly would have said no to in the past. I guess the most notable one was in 2001 when my husband left our family. The boys were 7 and 5 and I was now a single blind parent. The Blind Foundation asked me if I wanted to learn Braille and I said why not. And I went out to the Blind Foundation once a week and I fell in love with Braille. I found it liberating once again to be able to read with my fingers, to be reunited with the written word. And I also fell in love with Louis Braille. So when it came time for the international blind community to celebrate his 200th birthday in Paris on the 4th of January 2009, I wanted to be there. So I said, why not, to going, raise some money and headed over to Paris with my new partner, Ron. And on the 4th of January, climbed to the top of the Eiffel Tower, got out in the lift and poked my head through the railing and called out over the city of Paris, "Happy birthday, Louis Braille." When we came home through Egypt and Jordan and visited Petra, which is, of course, one of the 7 wonders of the world. And I said to Ron, I wonder what the other 6 are. So we set ourselves a goal of visiting the 7 wonders of the world, which in 2014 we completed when we visited South America, going through Christ the Redeemer in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, Machu Picchu in Peru, and finishing off with our 7th wonder, Chichen Itza in Mexico. So that was a pretty amazing accomplishment. And then in 2014, I actually got melanoma and the test results came back clear. So we left the hospital and went round to the travel agent and we wrote ourselves a bucket list that included places that I'd always wanted to go to, and Ron the same. So we both set out on July the 4th, 2015 and visited 20 countries in 107 days. And people often ask me, how can you sightsee when you can't see? And I say, because I can smell, hear, taste and touch. And on that trip, I smelt fermenting barley in the whisky distillery at Glenmorangie in the Highlands of Scotland. I stood on the bridge at Westminster and heard Big Ben chime 12. I ate German pretzels at the oldest cloister brewery in the world. And I touched the Liberty Bell in the United States of America. So it was a wonderful opportunity. At that stage, I'd visited 49 countries. And earlier this year, on the 1st of February, it was my 50th birthday. And I said to Ron, wouldn't it be great to do 50 countries by the time I was 50? I said, would you like to go to Samoa? And he said, why not? So we went to Samoa and I spent my 50th birthday in Samoa. So saying why not has taken me to lots of countries around the world. It's made me walk 9 half marathons and it's enabled me to referee 3 games of nude touch rugby. It has made me write a book, cycle the Otago Rail Trail, which is 150 kilometres on a tandem bike, talk to people all around the country, to go up in a hot air balloon, to do all that stuff. But it's meant that I've been open to the opportunities that have come my way as a blind woman, and for that I'm truly grateful.
Julie Woods in New Zealand, thank you for sharing, Julie. And yeah, she's really been through it all, hasn't she? You know, she's had full sight, partial sight, and then no sight. What's interesting about Julie is she wrote a 7-word story, and I remember reading this a few months ago, actually, before we got in contact with Julie to do this feature. And it was a 7-word story she'd written about life with sight loss and going through that whole journey. And the 7-word story was sighted, partially sighted, blind. Happy, sad, happy. Make of that what you will. But I think it's a really interesting story. That was her 7-word story that she wrote. Julie, good to hear from you. This is the Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio. If you want to share a story or comment on anything you've heard here, then please do get in touch. weeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. This is your programme. You set the agenda, so get in touch. Now, for our pause for thought this week, our guide dog story, our relationship with guide dogs and their owners, we hear from Lynette Proctor and Pippa, the guide dog.
My name is Lynette Proctor. I have a guide dog and her name is Pippa. We qualified in March 2013, so I've had her sort of over 3.5 years now. We've done so many things since I got Pippa. When I first applied for a guide dog, I wasn't going out independently at all. I was having to go to hospital appointments, college counselling sessions, all supported by my mum, which for being in your early 20s, you don't really want to have to take your mum everywhere with you. My mum says that she was a brilliant guide, but when we used to walk into supermarkets, she'd get distracted by a really good deal and then I'd be left standing in the middle of the shop, not knowing where she'd gone and what she was looking at. So having a dog, to me, felt that maybe I was going to be able to sort of look at the things that I wanted to do and maybe not prioritise the boring things like shopping and counselling and hospitals and be able to do things that were a bit more spontaneous. Not long sort of after getting her, I'd said so many times that I kept saying no to things that I wanted to start saying yes. So we agreed to travel up to the Lake District and do a lot of work with kids and young people who have got sight loss. We started traveling down to London for work and to sort of visit my friend in Birmingham a lot. So the more Pippa kind of got used to getting out and about, the more sort of relaxed she became at all these long train journeys and working in places that maybe she wasn't familiar with. I do think that Pippa comes well before my needs, remembering that when we're going out in the morning to make sure she's got everything that we need for the day. Quite often my handbag or my suitcase, if we're on long journeys, is half full of like her dog bed, her toys, her food, her water bowl, enough water for the journey. I've had to plan all the sort of stops off and everything. It's almost like having a child with you quite a lot. And we have travelled around sort of on very sort of like long train journeys where I have on occasion sort of not long after getting her, we stuck on a train that had been cancelled a few times and I've gone, oh no, what if she needs to go and spend which obviously she didn't. She's really well trained, but I didn't know how long she could hold it in for, to the point where she sort of signaled to me that she might need to go. So we've learned that long train journeys, it means that we have to make sure we've factored that sort of time into our transport, like links and everything. One of the big things about having a dog is people are constantly amazed about the work that they do, and you do have people coming up to you all the time, but sometimes it can be negative. Sometimes you can have somebody jump down in front of you and kneel on the floor at a train station and try and talk to the dog while you're walking along the platform, and people don't understand that, well, this dog's doing a job, it's trying to avoid me going onto the track, and you're suddenly squatting down and speaking to her and distracting her from my work. But then other times you might be actually needing support. If I have been sat somewhere and somebody's come over to offer me assistance but asked the stranger next to me instead, who had no idea because they weren't even with me, they were just sat on the same group of chairs. The thing is, if I hadn't had Pippa, people didn't know, because I wasn't a cane user. I used to find the cane very restricting. I used to describe it as sort of like pushing a shopping trolley where the shakes sort of go up your arm. And I found everything about using the cane quite sort of negative, whereas I'd always loved animals. So to choose to have a guide dog for me felt like a perfect thing, because I didn't see her as a negative. I saw her as something that I could interact with and something that could actually sort of force me to get out and about and do more things. And some of the things that we've done really are amazing. Like last year, me and Pippa did a fundraising challenge where we actually raised enough money to name our own guide dog puppy, who's currently in training. And we climbed a mountain together, which, if you'd have asked me before I had her, would I have had the confidence not only to leave the front door and get out and about independently, to be able to go back to work, to be able to finish studies, to be able to just do everything that I should be able to do, but could I actually go on then and climb a mountain? Or I even learned to scuba dive and got my scuba license. There's so many different things that, yes, she's helped me get out and about, but she's also allowed me to do even more than I'd ever expected. And I don't know what I'm going to end up doing next year, because I didn't know this year that what I was going to end up doing. So it's quite exciting, but it allows me to get excited about everything as well, and allows me to sort of be who I want to be and not be sort of anything dictated to me just because of my vision.
Lynette, thanks for sharing your story. Has your guide dog changed your life in the way that Lynette's life has changed? Well, do get in touch and tell us about it. weeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Now, one final story for you, and this is an interesting one from Maggie Tolmy, who has had partial sight since her late teens, early 20s, following laser surgery and a head injury which detached her retinas. Now, Maggie is an actress and a mezzo-soprano. She's formally trained and has 10 years' experience in a variety of theatre and contemporary musical theatre roles. She spoke to her own Ben Newby about her decision to follow her passion and go to drama school after losing her sight.
I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I was at school, and just sort of floated along like everybody else does to university, and thought, oh, languages, that's quite interesting. Went to uni, started to notice some kind of eye problems, just thought I needed glasses. Pootered along, ended up needing some laser treatment for stuff at the back. I didn't understand. At 19, 20, you don't know what's going on. My retina's detached. I mean, it was a very difficult time, because your life, it doesn't stop, but it has to change overnight. So I finished my degree, and I had just gone along thinking, oh, I'll be a medical interpreter, but I'd really always wanted to be an actor. I thought, oh, do you know what? I'm going to go to drama school. And I waddled along to Morley College. They accommodated me and my white cane. And here we are 10 years later. It was the biggest learning experience of my life. Life now it's great. I mean, yeah, I wish I could see 100%, but I love what I do. I create, I pretend to be other people for a living. And it's like being a child, and people clap. And I think mainly because my mum was obsessed with Elizabeth Taylor. She shared a birthday with her. I would see, you know, mums look after you when they nag, and that's what they do when they cook. But I saw her amazing reaction to Elizabeth Taylor on Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, and I thought, whoa, well, if this woman's getting this reaction from my mum, I would love to do that. And mum always wanted to be an actor, but she, you know, she did the normal thing. She became a welfare officer and had children. And as well as the drama training, I trained as a mezzo-soprano. It was always, you know, some kind of performing, maybe music, maybe drama. And it's nice to have the choice. It's nice to maybe do a singing thing, maybe do a mixy thing. Out of everything, I don't want to jinx my future, but out of everything, comedy roles are probably my favourite because you get to be a complete idiot and people thank you for it. The official training started at Morley, and then I went on to City Lit, and then I found private tutors. It was scary and it was fantastic. It was everything because a door opened, a door in my head opened, and oh, God, I'm cringing as I say this, but I just saw a light. I saw a path forward and I didn't look back. It's not easy because you'll be competing in auditions and for places in plays and concerts with people who have fantastic vision and who went to conservatory and all this kind of thing. But the most important thing is you have to want it. You have to stay focused and you have to stay positive. It's not easy, but it just helps. Sometimes with a disability, because I do see sight loss as a disability, and I don't think disability is a dirty word. I really don't. And I don't think people should avoid using it. Sometimes with a condition, you will get people saying no simply because they're scared of what you might do to yourself. They're scared about insurance things. Oh, what if she suddenly falls down the stairs that she's never fallen down before? You have to stay positive. And somebody said to me, you actually have to be a little bit better. No, you just have to be as good as them. Because when you can present to a director or a concert manager who likes you and they're like, oh my God, and she's got this level of sight loss, they want you. You make them look good. They're using a disabled person. Hooray for them. You know, it's not easy. The most important thing is establishing good connections with people that you've worked with before in the past and bringing that CV and showing them what you can do. Get good. Get really good. You don't need to be better than everybody, but you need to be good and you need to want it. You need to want it and be hungry for it. I mean, do it as a hobby by all means. Join a local company, learn the skills. But you have to want it because that's what directors pick up on. They pick up on the energy, because if you have that energy to want it, that'll feed into the work you do.
Maggie, thanks for sharing your story. And that's it for the Weekly Connect. Thanks to everyone who took part. Just enough time to say next week we've got some big news about a shared space scheme in Northumberland that has been scrapped. Big news. What's your views on them, though, and the rest of the country? Get in touch. Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk.